Readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Have you ever wondered why science fiction, our focus today, has such enthusiastic fans? Could it be as simple as the stories take you on fantastic journeys to outer space? And sometimes to interior worlds more foreign than intergalactic travel? A love of sci-fi is anchored in a love of complexity, an appreciation of independent thinking. And of course, the popular consensus is that sci-fi speaks to people who feel some degree of alienation. But haven't we all felt like an outsider at some point? It's part and parcel of the human condition. Today's show features award-winning sci-fi books. And you're going to love my guest, especially if you've ever enjoyed a Star Wars movie. Intrigued? Stay right where you are as we turn to page one of the book report. In Joe Walton's My Real Children, it's 2015, and Patricia Cowan is very old. Confused today, reads the note clip to the end of her bed. She forgets things she should know, what year it is, major events in the lives of her children. But she remembers things that don't seem possible. She remembers marrying Mark and having four children. And she remembers not marrying Mark and raising three children with Bea. She remembers the bomb that killed President Kennedy. And she remembers Kennedy in 1964 declining to run again after the nuclear exchange that took out Miami and Kiev. Her childhood, her years at Oxford during World War II, those were solid things. But after that, did she marry Mark or not? Do her friends call her Pat or Trish? Was she a housewife who escaped a terrible marriage or a successful travel writer with homes in Britain and Italy? And the moon outside her window, does it host a benign research station or a command post bristling with nuclear missiles? Two lives, two worlds, two versions of modern history, each with loves and losses, sorrows and triumphs. Jo Walton's My Real Children is the tale of both of Patricia Cowan's lives and how every life means the entire world. Allison Larkin narrates.
Confused today, they wrote on her notes. Confused. Less confused. Very confused. That last was written frequently, sometimes abbreviated by the nurses to just VC, which made her smile as if she were sufficiently confused to be given a medal for it. Her name was on the notes too, just her first name. Patricia, as if in old age she were demoted to childhood and denied both the dignity of surname and title and the familiarity of the form of her name she preferred. The notes reminded her of a school report with the little boxes and fixed categories into which it was so difficult to express the real complexity of any situation. Spelling atrocious. Needs to pay attention. Confused today. They seemed remote and Olympian and impossible to appeal. But Miss, the kids would say in more recent years. She would never have dared when she was in school, and neither would the obedient girls of her first years of teaching. But Miss was a product of their growing confidence, trickle-down feminism, and she welcomed it even as it made her daily work harder. She wanted to say it now herself to the nurses who added to her notes. But, Miss, I'm only a little confused today. The notes hung clipped to the end of her bed. They listed her medication, the stuff for her heart she had been taking for years since the first attack. She was grateful that they remembered it for her now, the abrupt Latin syllables. She liked to check the notes from time to time, even though the staff discouraged it if they caught her at it. The notes had the date, which otherwise was hard to remember, and even the day of the week, which she so easily lost track of here, where all days were alike. She could even forget what time of year it was, going out so seldom, which she would have thought impossible. Not knowing the season really was a sign of severe confusion. Sometimes, especially at first, she looked at the notes to see how confused she appeared to them, but often lately she forgot, and then forgot what she had forgotten to do among the constant morass of things she needed to keep track of, and the endless muddle of notes reminding herself of what she had meant to do. She had found a list once that began, "Make list." VC, the attendants would have written if they had seen it, but that was long before the dementia began, when she had been still quite young, although she had not thought so at the time. She had never felt older than those years when the children were small and so demanding of her attention. She had felt it a new lease on youth when they were grown and gone, and the constant drain on her time and caring was relieved. Not that she had ever stopped caring. Even now, when she saw their faces impossibly middle-aged, she felt that same burden of unconditional loving tugging at her, their needs and problems, and her inability to keep them safe and give them what they wanted.
We've just heard My Real Children by Jo Walton. Lock-In is an inventive near-future thriller from Hugo Award winner John Scalzi. The version we'll sample today, performed by Will Wheaton, was also recognized by Audiophile as Best Voices in the Sci-Fi, Fantasy, and Audio Theater category. Publishers Weekly described the book as a shift away from Scalzi's signature space operas to a story resonant with themes of freedom, ethics, and corporate greed. Not too long from today, a new, highly contagious virus makes its way across the globe. Most who get sick experience nothing worse than flu-like symptoms. But for the unlucky 1%, nearly 5 million in the U.S. alone, the disease causes lock-in. Victims are fully awake and aware, but unable to move or respond to stimulus. The disease affects young, old, rich, poor, people of every color and creed. A quarter of a century later, in a world shaped by what's now known as Hayden's syndrome, rookie FBI agent Chris Shane and veteran agent Leslie Vann are assigned to what appears to be a Hayden-related murder, with a suspect who's an integrator, someone who can let the locked in borrow their bodies. If the integrator was carrying a Hayden client, then naming the suspect for the murder becomes very complicated. As Shane and Vann begin to unravel the threads of the murder, it becomes clear the real mystery and the real crime is bigger than anyone could have imagined.
We went inside and took the elevator to the 7th floor, from which the love seat had been flung. Vann pinned her FBI badge to her lapel. I slotted mine into my chest display. The elevator doors opened up, and a uniformed cop was there. She held up her hand to stop us from getting off. We both pointed to our badges. She grimaced and let us pass, whispering into her handset as she did so. We aimed for the room that had cops all around the door. We got about halfway to it when a woman poked her head out of the room, looked around, spied us, and stomped over. I glanced over at Vann, who had a smirk on her face. "Detective Trin," Vann said as the woman came up. "No," Trin said. "No way. This has nothing to do with you, Les." "It's nice to see you too," Vann said. "And wrong, your perp is an integrator. You know what that means." All suspected crimes involving personal transports or integrators are assumed to have an interstate component, I said, quoting the Bureau handbook. Trin looked over at me sourly, then made a show of ignoring me to speak to Vann. I tucked away that bit of personal interaction for later. "I don't know my perp's an integrator," she said to Vann. "I do," Vann said. "When your officer on scene called it in, he ID'd the perp. It's Nicholas Bell. Bell's an integrator. He's in our database. He pinged the moment your guy ran him." I turned my head to look at Vann at the mention of the name, but she kept looking at Trin. "Just because he's got the same name doesn't make him an integrator," Trin said. "Come on, Trin," Vann said. "Are we really going to do this in front of the children?" It took me a second to realize Vann was talking about me and the uniformed cops. "You know it's a pissing match you're going to lose. Let us in, let us do our job. If it turns out everyone involved was in D.C. at the time, we'll turn over everything we have and be out of your hair. Let's play nice and do this all friendly. Or I could not be friendly. You remember how that goes." Trin turned and stomped back to the hotel room without another word. "I'm missing some context," I said. You got about all you need, Van said. She headed to the room, number 714. I followed. There was a dead body in the room, on the floor, face down in the carpet, throat cut. The carpet was soaked in blood. There were sprays of blood on the walls, on the bed, and on the remaining seat in the room. A breeze turned in the room, provided by the gaping hole in the wall-length window that the love seat had gone through. Van looked at the dead body. Do we know who he is? No ID, Trin said. We're working on it. Van looked around, trying to find something. Where's Nicholas Bell? She asked Trin. Trin smiled thinly. At the precinct, she said. The first officer on the scene subdued him, and we sent him off before you got here. Who is the officer? Van asked. Timmons, Trin said. He's not here. I need his arrest feed, Van said. I don't now, Trin, Van said. You know my public address. Give it to Timmons. Trin turned away, annoyed, but pulled out her phone and spoke into it. Van pointed to the uniformed officer in the room. Anything moved or touched? Not by us, he said. Van nodded. Shane. Yeah? I said. Make a map, Van said. Make it detailed. Mind the glass. On it, I said. My recording mode was already on. I overlaid a three-dimensional grid on top of it, marking off everything I could see and making it easier to identify where I needed to look behind and under things. I walked the room, carefully, filling in the nooks and crannies. I knelt down when I got to the bed, turning on my headlight to make sure I got all the details. And there were, in fact, details to note under the bed. There's a glass under here, I said to Van. It's broken and covered in blood. I stood up and pointed over to the room's desk, which featured a set of glasses and a couple of bottles of water. There are also glass shards on the floor by the desk, guessing that's our murder weapon. You done with your map? Van said. Almost, I said. I took a few more passes around the room to pick up the spots I'd missed. I assume you also made your own map, Van said to Trin. We got the tech on the way, Trin said, and we've got the feeds from the officers on the scene. I want all of them, Van said. I'll send you Shane's map, too. Fine, Trin said, annoyed. Anything else? That's it for now, Van said. Then if you don't mind stepping away from my crime scene, I have work to do, Trin said. Van smiled at Trin and left the room. I followed. Metro Police always like that? I asked as we stepped into the elevator. No one likes the feds stepping into their turf, Van said. They're never happy to see us.
That was Lock-In by John Scalzi. Ian Desher blends his love of Star Wars with a finely tuned appreciation for the bard, Mr. William Shakespeare. Ian has created the insanely original William Shakespeare's Star Wars trilogy and beyond Star Wars, Verily a New Hope, The Empire Striketh Back, The Jedi Doth Return, and now The Phantom of Menace, Star Wars, Part the First. Ian received his BA in music from Yale University, a Master of Divinity from Yale Divinity School, and a PhD in ethics from the Union Theological Seminary. He lives with his wife and two children in Portland, where he's the director of nonprofit marketing at Pivot Group LLC, a full-service marketing, research, and web agency. Ian, welcome to the Book Report.
Thank you so much.
First question, and it's an obvious one. How in the world, or in a galaxy far, far away, did you develop the idea to rewrite Star Wars as Shakespeare would have done?
Three things happened right around the same time, about 3 years ago. I watched the original trilogy with some good friends of mine from high school, and then not too long after that, I read Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which is one of the first really popular mashups. And then just after finishing that book, went to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival with my family. And so I sort of had Star Wars and mashups and Shakespeare all bouncing around in my head, and was actually at the Shakespeare Festival when I had the idea, you know, wouldn't it be fun to rewrite Star Wars as though it were a play written by Shakespeare?
Okay. Well, you're not a literature major, so how did you master the specific challenges of writing in iambic pentameter?
That was definitely a challenge early on, you know, getting used to the language and sort of the rhythm of speech in iambic pentameter. And so what I found, though, is that over time it it's like a muscle. You know, the more you exercise it, the stronger it gets. So I got more used to the vocabulary, more used to sort of making things flow in verse. And so it was a challenge, but a fun one for sort of a nerd like me.
I'm wondering if your musical background helped with the rhythm of the writing.
You know, I think a bit, yeah. Certainly, I had written some songs, and so when you're writing lyrics, you're trying to write in at least some kind of verse, and you're getting used to rhyme and that sort of thing. So definitely, having a musical background didn't hurt.
Well, Star Wars, of course, has some of the most devoted fans of any literature around. How have they responded to the book?
Star Wars fans in general have been really warm and have really embraced the books. I think they like the fact that they're getting sort of new insight into their favorite characters, because with Shakespeare, you get these soliloquies and asides to the audience where, you know, characters are sort of explaining more about their motivation and how they're feeling and that sort of thing. And I think that, you know, sort of helps Star Wars fans say, oh, this isn't just a plain retelling. It really is sort of giving us something a little bit new.
Right. I was surprised to see that R2-D2 had a speaking part in the book in the asides. How have fans reacted to that?
You know, I think that was probably the most popular thing from the first book. It actually happened because when we first sent the manuscript off to Lucasfilm, I had written the first act, so basically the first fifth of the book, and they wrote back and said, you know, we like what you've done so far, but we want to see if you can have more fun with it. Go ahead and play around with the characters more and take it outside the bounds of the movie and make it your own. And so I went back and revised the first couple of scenes, in one of which has C-3PO and R2-D2 in it. And so I thought, you know, wouldn't it be fun if we actually gave R2 a speaking voice? He can't speak to other characters. He's not allowed to, but for whatever reason. But he can turn to the audience and explain how he's feeling, and then we sort of get to experience his snarky personality a little bit.
You know, speaking of which, I think we need to speak about Jar Jar Binks, who figures very prominently in this book. He's actually a pretty complex guy.
Yeah, so Jar Jar, you know, is one of the sort of most controversial characters in the Star Wars world, because although many people like him, even more people dislike him and sort of felt that he really hurt the movie The Phantom Menace, because he was just so silly and so dumb. And so revisiting that movie and retelling it, I wanted to do something different with Jar Jar so that people would basically reconsider him if they'd written him off. So what I did was, you know, he's still sort of like R2-D2. He still is, you know, speaking to other characters in this sort of dumb speech. He's acting basically like a fool around them. But then in these asides to the audience, we find out that he is actually very aware of what he's doing, and he's sort of steering events the way that he wants them to go, so that he can unite his people, the Gungans, with the Naboo, who are the other people who share his planet, who have historically been at odds with each other. So I wanted to give him this very intentional, very wise sort of role that he doesn't have at all in the movie, as a way of sort of saying, you know, that there might be more to this guy than you think.
Well, back to George Lucas, might there be interest in ever filming the plays?
You know, I think anything's possible. Lucasfilm owns the copyright to the book, so they're the ones who would make the call about a movie or maybe staged versions or anything like that. So, you know, I certainly think it would be fun to see a live performance of it.
I think so, too. Have you heard anything from the actors who starred in the films, like Harrison Ford or Carrie Fisher?
Well, you know, it's funny. Star Wars Celebration, the big Star Wars conference or whatever you want to call it, extravaganza, just happened this past weekend. And Ian McDiarmid, who played Emperor Palpatine in the movies, he actually read a speech during his panel from one of my books and sort of commented a bit on it. That was just sort of amazing for me as both an author and a fan to see that happen. I also had a chance to meet Mark Hamill and give him a book, so hopefully he is taking a minute to look at that and read it.
We're speaking with Ian Desher on the Book Report. Amazed I am at how well you wrote my favorite, Yoda. Which characters presented the biggest writing challenges for you?
I think it was characters who are sort of larger than life in some way, and so you know you need to do well by them. And so Anakin Skywalker slash Darth Vader, you know, making sure that you really represent the arc of that character well. Obi-Wan Kenobi, who is such an important, wise character. Certainly Yoda figuring out initially what I was going to do with his speech was something that that sort of was a challenge early on. And also a character like Emperor Palpatine, you know, who's so evil and sort of getting inside his head a bit. Yeah, I think it's sort of those really sort of big, hefty Shakespearean characters.
Was there one Star Wars character who you identified with most closely?
Well, I always say that when I was a kid, I really wanted to be Han Solo, but my personality is much more C-3PO. I think I tend to be that sort of, you know, slightly worried, nervous sort of character, who's sort of the big nerd in the midst of cooler people.
Well, how has your fan base built since book one, Star Wars, Verily a New Hope?
The initial book had such a great reception, again, both from Star Wars fans and from theater people. And things have just sort of continued to build since then. People who hadn't heard of the books now are coming to hear of it. I hear from a lot of theater people who, you know, want to see these performed or want to perform them themselves. And so it's just, you know, it's continued to grow and sort of be this this rising tide. And it's been so humbling for me as an author to sort of be embraced by so many people.
I'm wondering, what do you think of when you see high school editions of Shakespearean plays with dialogue that has been modernized, written in idiomatic English?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, part of me wonders, you know, what's the point? And I don't mean that flippantly, but I mean, Shakespeare wrote wonderful stories, just stories unto themselves. And so to retell the stories makes a lot of sense. But for me, you know, half of the point of Shakespeare is his language. And delving into the beauty of his language and his wordplay and all of that. And yes, it can be confusing. And so I do totally understand why modern adaptations, you know, modernized adaptations, I understand why they're popular and why they're done, because it does at least sort of help kids get into the story of Shakespeare, but without sort of making adding the additional challenge of language. But for me, I think you lose something in that also, because you're not getting the same richness that you do in reading Shakespeare's actual language.
Well, I couldn't agree more. How would you convince a kid who loves Star Wars but is very hesitant about embracing Shakespeare to pick up one of your books?
Well, I would say give it a try, because I think my books can be understood and not be too threatening, you know, because yes, I am using some of Shakespeare's language, but it's not so much so that you can't understand it, especially if you're familiar with the stories. And I think I would also encourage them to try reading it out loud, because Shakespeare was meant to be performed, and I think that's true with my quasi-attempt at Shakespeare also, is, you know, that it's in hearing it out loud and you know, getting into the speeches and that sort of thing that I think you really end up having fun with it.
Right, and plus, as you say, you're asides with characters that you're not used to hearing from.
Right, exactly. So you sort of get to know more about these characters that you already thought you knew well.
So what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a couple of other projects in verse, because I really enjoy writing in verse, and not a ton of people are doing it right now, so things like that. And I'm also working on a novel centered around Shakespearean characters, so we'll see what happens.
And not another Star Wars book?
Well, that's always possible. There, you know, the new movie is coming out, Episode 7, and there is a possibility that at some point we'll see a Shakespearean version of that as well.
All right. Well, final thoughts about The Phantom of Menace?
I hope people enjoy it. It's the first of the prequel series, and the rest of the trilogy comes out this year. The Clone Army attacketh in July, and The Tragedy of the Sith's Revenge in September.
Well, Ian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
The Phantom Menace is not yet out in audio, so let's listen to Desher's William Shakespeare's The Empire Striketh Back. It's book two in the trilogy that began with the Audiophile Audi Award finalist William Shakespeare's Star Wars, a sample of which you'll find at bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of April 12, 2014. Return to the star-crossed galaxy far, far away as the brooding young hero, a power-mad emperor, and their jesting droids match wits, struggle for power, and soliloquize in elegant and impeccable iambic pentameter. Verily, something Wookiee this way comes. An ensemble cast performs the book.
Han, my true companion heir, canst thou hear me?
Aye, truly, Chuck. Thy voice rings loud and clear. What can I do for thee, my noble friend?
My circle round the area hath been completed now, but naught of life nor forms of life my scan hath yet uncovered.
Nay, there's not life enough upon this cube of ice to fill an empty space cruiser. The sensors have I put in place, so shall I now return unto the base.
'Tis well, and I, forsooth, shall soon meet with thee there. But I have spied a meteorite that hath its landing made near here. So shall I go and fix my eyes upon the scene. I'll not be long, I warrant. Then I shall return.
Enter Wampa aside.
You viewers all, whose gentle hearts do fear the smallest womprat creeping on the floor, may now perchance both quake and tremble here when Wampa Roth in wildest rage doth roar. Pray know that I a Wampa simple am, and take no pleasure in my angry mood. Though with great force this young one's face I slam, I prithee know I strike but for my food.
Alas, is this the adventure I am due, to die upon a vicious monster's whim? I am attacked by this awful beast. Oh, fate most wretched! Shall I be his feast?
Exit, pursued by a Wampa. Scene 2. The Rebel Base on Hoth. Enter Han Solo.
A scoundrel may not rise above his place. This is a fact the galaxy doth teach. For e'en though I have joined Rebellion's ranks these many weeks and months, and gained respect within their noble band, my scoundrel past doth make its harsh demands upon my life. The bounty hunter sent by Jabba make pursuit to win the price upon my head. So must I go once more into the depths of my old life, find Jabba of the Hutt, and pay his ransom, thus to free my soul. I would not leave my noble rebel friends. I would not leave the cause for which they fight. I would not leave the princess and her charm. I would not leave all these, and yet I must. A life's not well lived under threat of death, especially with men of cruel intent, who for a price shall fill the Hutt's demands upon the trail of my indebtedness. And so, my mate Chewbacca and I leave upon the instant that the ship is set to go.
Enter Chewbacca, working on the Millennium Falcon.
I say, Chewbacca, ho! Aye, Chewie! Lose not thy temper, gentle Wookiee. Nay, but practice patience. I shall help thee soon.
Exit Chewbacca. Han crosses to Command Center with Princess Leia and General Ryken.
Solo, wouldst thou speak with me?
Good General, the sensors are in place, and surely shalt thou know if aught comes near our hidden station here.
Well, prithee say, Commander Skywalker, hath he yet made report?
Nay, truly. He hath gone to see a meteorite that hath made landfall near.
With all the meteorites a-falling in this system, I believe we shall have pains and trouble in detecting approaching ships.
How shall I tell my news most difficult, and crush this man's great hopes for what's ahead? Fear not, O heart, but be direct and calm. 'Tis best to approach straight on, like the Kessel Run. My general, I cannot stay. I must make haste and get me hence e'en now.
Alack, how like a death knell sounds this news to me.
I tell thee truly when I say to thee, This news doth break this general's gentle soul. I could not be more sorry, Pilot Brave.
A price still lies upon my head, and if I do not make amends with Jabba, I shall not repay with money, nay, but life.
A price too dear indeed. A death mark is no kind companion to a free man's life. Thou art a warrior noble, Solo, and I hate to lose thee.
And thou art a kind, good general, Sarah. I hate to go.
Exit Ryken. Han turns to Princess Leia.
And so, Your Highness Great, this is the end.
'Tis so.
I prithee mourn me not and show no sentiment. Farewell, thou Princess Cold.
We've just heard William Shakespeare's The Empire Strikes Back by Ian Desher. Author Anne Leckie was universally acclaimed in 2014. She became the first author to win the Arthur C. Clarke, Nebula, and Hugo Awards, all in the same year. In Ancillary Justice, book one in her award-winning trilogy, we meet the soldier known as Breck on a remote, icy planet. Breck is drawing closer to completing her quest. She is both more than she seems and less than she was. Years ago, she was the Justice of Torin, a colossal starship with an artificial intelligence linking thousands of soldiers in the service of the Ratch, the empire that conquered the galaxy. An act of treachery has ripped it all away, leaving her with only one fragile human body and only one purpose, to revenge herself. It's a galactic thriller, but word of warning, you may want to choose the print version of this book. Most readers seem not to be a fan of the audio edition's narrator, Celeste Sciulla.
"I'll rent a sledge," I said, "and buy a hypothermia kit." Behind me, one of the patrons chuckled and said, voice mocking, "Aren't you a tough little girl?" I turned to look at her, to study her face. She was taller than most Nilters, but fat and pale as any of them. She outbulked me, but I was taller, and I was also considerably stronger than I looked. She didn't realize what she was playing with. She was probably male, to judge from the angular maze-like patterns quilting her shirt. I wasn't entirely certain. It wouldn't have mattered if I had been in Roch space. Rodchai don't care much about gender, and the language they speak, my own first language, doesn't mark gender in any way. This language we were speaking now did, and I could make trouble for myself if I used the wrong forms. It didn't help that cues meant to distinguish gender changed from place to place, sometimes radically, and rarely made much sense to me. I decided to say nothing. After a couple of seconds, she suddenly found something interesting in the tabletop. I could have killed her right there without much effort. I found the idea attractive. But right now, Save Arden was my first priority. I turned back to the barkeep. Slouching negligently, she said, as though there had been no interruption,
"What kind of place you think this is?"
"The kind of place," I said, still safely in linguistic territory that needed no gender marking, "that will rent me a sledge and sell me a hypothermia kit." "How much?"
200 shen.
At least twice the going rate, I was sure.
"For the sledge out back, you'll have to get it yourself. Another 100 for the kit."
"Complete," I said, "not used." She pulled one out from under the bench, and the seal looked undamaged.
"Your buddy out there had a tab."
Maybe a lie, maybe not. Either way, the number would be pure fiction.
"How much?" 350.
I could find a way to keep avoiding referring to the barkeep's gender, or I could guess. It was, at worst, a 50-50 chance. "You're very trusting," I said, guessing male, "to let such an indigent..." I knew Save Arden was male, that one was easy. "Run up such a debt." The barkeep said nothing. 650 covers all of it?
Yeah, said the barkeep. Pretty much.
No, all of it. We will agree now. And if anyone comes after me later demanding more, or tries to rob me, they die.
Silence.
The sound behind me of someone spitting.
Rodchai scum.
I'm not Rodchai, which was true. You have to be human to be Rodchai.
He is, said the barkeep,
with the smallest shrug toward the door.
You don't have the accent, but you stink like Rodchai.
That's the swill you serve your customers. Hoots from the patrons behind me. I reached into a pocket, pulled out a handful of chits, and tossed them on the bench. Keep the change. I turned to leave.
Your money better be good.
Your sledge had better be out back where you said. And I left. The hypothermia kit first. I rolled Savarden over. Then I tore the seal on the kit, snapped an internal off the card, and pushed it into her bloody, half-frozen mouth. Once the indicator on the card showed green, I unfolded the thin wrap, made sure of the charge, wound it around her, and switched it on. Then I went around back for the sledge. No one was waiting for me, which was fortunate. I didn't want to leave bodies behind just yet. I hadn't come here to cause trouble.
We've just heard Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie. Some stories cannot be told in just one lifetime. Harry August is on his deathbed again. In The First 15 Lives of Harry August by Claire North, no matter what he does or the decisions he makes, when death comes, Harry always returns to where he began, a child with all the knowledge of a life he has already lived a dozen times before. Nothing ever changes. Until now. As Harry nears the end of his 11th life, a little girl appears at his bedside. I nearly missed you, Dr. August, she says. I need to send a message. This is the story of what Harry does next, and what he did before, and how he tries to save a past he cannot change and a future he cannot allow. Peter Kenny performs the book.
Mental health professionals of the 1960s make their 1990s counterparts look like Mozarts trampling upon Salieri's lesser work. I suppose I should consider myself fortunate that some of the more experimental techniques of the 1960s had not yet made their way to cosmopolitan Northumbria. I was not tested on with LSD or ecstasy, nor invited to discuss my sexuality, as our one and only psychiatrist, Dr. Abel, regarded Freud as unsanitary. The first to discover this was the Twitch, an unfortunate woman whose real name was Lucy, whose Tourette's syndrome was treated by a mixture of apathy and brutality. If our warders had a notion of habit-breaking therapy, they acted upon it by hitting Lucy across the side of her head with the palms of their hands whenever she twitched or grunted. And if she became louder as a consequence, as frequently happened when provoked, two of them would sit on top of her, one on her legs, one on her chest, until she nearly passed out beneath them. The one time I attempted to intervene, I received the same treatment and lay pinned beneath Ugly Bill, the head day-shift nurse and sometime jailbird, to the vociferous approval of Clara Watkins and Newbie, who'd worked there for 6 months and still hadn't said his name. Newbie stood on my wrists, mostly to show willing, while Ugly Bill explained to me that I was being very naughty and disruptive, and just because I thought I was a doctor didn't mean I knew anything. I cried with impotence and frustration, and he slapped me, which gave me cause to rage, and through which rage I tried to control my tears, converting self-pity into fury. Dr. Abel, his tiny moustache, quivering like a frightened mouse on his top lip, clicked his pen closed. Now, Lucy.
Come on, give it to me, give it to me, come on, come on, come on, come on, she screamed.
I watched the progress of the flush through Dr. Abel's cheeks. It was a fascinating luminescence, almost visible on a capillary-by-capillary basis, and I briefly wondered if the spread of his blush was representative of the speed of his blood flow through the shallow dermis, in which case he should seriously consider more exercise and a good massage. His moustache had ceased being fashionable the day after Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia, and the only thing I ever heard him say which made any sense was, "Dr. August, there is no greater isolation a man may experience than to be lonely in a crowd. He may nod and smile and say the right thing, but even by this pretense his soul is pushed further away from the kinship of men." I asked him what fortune cookie he'd got that from, and he looked bewildered and asked me what fortune cookies were and if you made them with ginger. "Give it to me! Give it to me!" screamed the twitch. "This is unproductive," he quavered, at which point Lucy pulled up her overall to show us her oversized knickers and started to dance, causing Simon, who was at the low point of his bipolar mania, to weep, which set off Margaret rocking, which caused Ugly Bill to storm into the room, stick in hand and straitjacket already on the way, while Dr. Abel, the tips of his ears burning like brake lights, scurried away. Once a month we were permitted visitors, and no one came. Simon said it was for the best, that he didn't want to be seen like this, that he was ashamed. Margaret screamed and tore at the walls until her nails were bloody and had to be taken back to her room and sedated. Lucy, the spittle rolling down her face, said it wasn't us who should be ashamed but them. She didn't say who they were, and nor did she need to, for she was simply right. After 2 months, I was ready to leave. "I see now," I explained calmly, sitting in front of Dr. Abel's desk, "that I suffered a mental breakdown. Obviously, I need counselling, but I can only express my deep and personal gratitude to you for having helped me overcome this issue." "Dr. August," explained Dr. Abel, lining up his pen with the top edge of his writing pad, "I think what you suffered was rather more than just a breakdown. You suffered a complete delusionary episode, indicative, I believe, of more complex psychological issues." I looked at Dr. Abel as though for the first time, and wondered just what his measure of success was. Not necessarily a cure, I decided, so long as the treatment was interesting. "What do you suggest?" I asked. "I'd like to keep you here a while longer," he replied. "There are some fascinating medications coming out, which I believe would be exactly what you need." "Medications?" "Some very promising developments have been made with the phenothiazines."
We've just heard The First 15 Lives of Harry August by Claire North. Critically acclaimed author Ben H. Winters has created the Edgar Award-winning Last Policeman series. Perhaps you've read Book 1, The Last Policeman, or Book 2, Countdown City. The third installment, World of Trouble, seems to be the most popular with readers, and that's the one we'll preview today. With the doomsday asteroid looming, Detective Hank Pallas has found sanctuary in the woods of New England, secure in a well-stocked safe house with other one-time members of the Concord Police Force. But with time ticking away before the asteroid makes landfall, Hank's safety is only relative, and his only relative, Sister Nico, is not safe. Soon it's clear there's more than one earth-shattering revelation on the horizon, and it's up to Hank to solve the puzzle before the time runs out for everyone. Peter Burkrot narrates.
Along the back wall is a dry erase board on wobbly wheels with an undated exhortation, all caps and triple underlined. "Stay safe." A smile, half smile. Imagining the weary young sergeant writing the message, hiding his own fear behind salty tough cop cleverness. "Stay safe. Keep a good eye on us, would you?" It hasn't been an easy time for law enforcement this last set of months. It really hasn't. I push through a door at the back of the muster room into an even smaller space. A kitchenette slash break room. Sink, fridge, microwave. Round table and black plastic chairs. I open the fridge and push it closed immediately against a wave of warmth and foul odor. Soured food, spoiled food. Rot. I stand in front of the empty vending machine and peer for a moment at my funhouse reflection in the plexiglass. There are no snacks in there. Just the bare coils like empty winter branches. But the glass is not smashed. Like all the world's glass seems to be these days. No one assaulted this machine with a bat or a Carhartt boot to rob it of its treasures. Presumably, this machine was emptied out ages ago. Maybe by Detective Russell, or by her disappointing friend Jason on his way out. Except, when I crouch down, take a knee and look closely, I find a plastic fork holding open the black horizontal door at the bottom where the food comes out. I shine my light on it, the fork dramatically bowed, the tensile strength of its hard plastic holding up precariously against the weight of the snack trap. Holy moly, is what I'm thinking, because this could be exactly what I'm looking for. Unless it isn't. Because theoretically, of course, a plastic fork could remain in that bowed position for a long time, for months even. But on the other hand, one of the many suspensions my sister earned during her rocky career at Concord High School was for performing the same trick, rigging open the vending machine in the teacher's lounge and looting all the candy bars and potato chips, leaving behind just the low-fat yogurt bars and a note, "You're welcome, fatties." When I catch my breath, I gingerly remove the fork. I have a dozen sandwich bags in my pocket, and I slip the fork into one of the bags and the bag into my sport coat pocket and move on. The kitchenette's two slim cupboards have been rummaged, plates broken and disarrayed, bowls tossed onto the floor. Only two coffee mugs are still intact, one reading, "Property of Rotary Police Department," the other, "I'm through with love. Fortunately, there's still sex." I smile and rub my bleary eyes. I miss cops. I really do. Was she here? Did Nico take the candy? The gooseneck spout of the sink is in the on position, angled up sharply to the left, as if someone came in for a glass of water, forgetting that the municipal supplies have stopped. Or perhaps the water went out right in the middle of someone using the sink. Some cop in the break room after a long and treacherous shift, filling up his cup or washing his face, her face. And suddenly, whoops, no more water for you. The sink is full of blood. It's a deep-walled sink with a basin made of stainless steel like the handle. And when I look down into it, the sides and the bottom are covered with a rust-red explosion of blood. The drain is clotted and thick with it. I look again at the gooseneck spout, closer now, shining the light, and find the faint smudged patches. Red bloody palms clutching and jerking the handle. Stay safe. Above and behind the sink, bolted to the wall, is a horizontal rack hung with three knives. All of them are stained with blood, up and down, freckled from hilt and blade. A clot of dread and excitement forms in the base of my gut and floats like a bubble up into my throat. I swing around, moving quickly now, heartbeat thrumming, back through the muster room and out into the hallway. And now the sun is all the way up outside, casting a muted ochre glow through the glass door, and I can see the floor clearly, see where the trail of blood runs down the hallway.
That was World of Trouble by Ben H. Winters. They killed me, but I survived. So begins Apollonia by Jamie McGuire. 3 years after Rory Reardon foiled her own murder, she still trusts no one. Not Dr. Z, the eccentric college professor who took her under his wing. Not Benji, the endearing, attractive classmate who insists on following her around. And certainly not Sai, the beautifully dark and mysterious boy who sits in the first row in Dr. Z's astrobiology class. When Rory witnesses Sai being abducted by soldiers in the middle of the night, she finds herself submersed in a world that holds even more secrets than she could imagine, even darker secrets than her own. Shea Sands performs the book.
Standing in front of my dorm room mirror, naked, I raked back my two long black bangs. Most girls gained a freshman 15. I'd been steadily losing weight for 2 years. It was hard to feel or taste or hurt after I'd died. There was nothing to celebrate anymore, so eating seemed more like a chore than anything else. A ratty white towel lay underneath my feet, ready to catch the dark locks that I began shearing away from above one ear and then the other.
I had thick and shiny hair that my father had said could have only come from my mother.
The scissors cut away all but 4 or 5 inches on top.
I ran my fingers over what was left. It felt so good. The sides and a bit of the back were shaved, and the hair left on top nearly grazed my jawline. It was appalling. It was liberating. I loved it. Not that many people at KIT noticed me anyway, but if they had, they definitely wouldn't recognize me now. 17 inches of shiny black hair that minutes ago had brushed the middle of my back were now lying on the floor. Every strand I'd sheared away had once been wet with my blood. Every time I saw my hair in the mirror or touched it, it was a reminder. No amount of shampoo would be enough to wash that night away. To make sure I wasn't just being impulsive, I had waited, but I couldn't wait any longer. After showering to wash the scratchy bits of hair from my skin, I stepped out and looked at my new reflection. It was a bit startling, but exponentially less repugnant. I zipped up my favorite black hoodie over a worn Kurt Cobain tee, fought with my gray skinny jeans, and then gave the small diamond piercing in the right side of my nose one full turn before grabbing my backpack. I looked back at the mirror, admiring the absence of my tainted hair, and letting the somber thought soak in that, had she been alive, my mother would have died all over again at the sight. Class 1 of week 1 of my junior year at KIT was geobiology and astrobiology with renowned astrobiologist Dr. A. Byron Zorba. Dr. Zorba was what he was called by students, but because he had been my father's mentor when Dad was a student here and later a family friend, I always called the professor Dr. Z. After my parents' funeral, Dr. Z told me I was going to Kempton, whether I wanted to or not, and he practically filled out my college application. He also made sure that my inheritance was funneled properly and swiftly into a college fund. Just before my first spring semester, Dr. Z offered me a position as his research assistant. Living on scientist salaries, my parents had struggled to pay the bills. And so a work-study program plus a research assistant scholarship would help subsidize my skimpy trust fund and provide for the day-to-day expenses that a college fund didn't cover. Freshly back from his most recent summer exploration trip to Antarctica, Dr. Z was still on a high from his find, a 12-inch by 15-inch 27-pound rock. I would be in charge of recording data. Admittedly, the rock didn't exactly impress me, so Dr. Z's enthusiasm was baffling. I walked into the classroom, immediately squinting from the morning sunshine pouring in from the numerous long windows that lined the opposite wall. Dr. Z's small and messy desk was at the bottom of a steep incline, center stage to dozens of tiny desks attached to uncomfortable chairs. I joined the line of students, making their way to whatever seat they chose, my feet shuffling slowly forward. "Hey," a familiar voice said right into my ear. I leaned away, recognized the face, and began climbing the stairs that hugged the windowless wall. For reasons completely unknown to me, Benji Reynolds had hunted me like a blue-tick coonhound since freshman orientation. I had hoped the new do would scare him away. He was clearly a mama's boy, and far too attractive and happy to appeal to me.
"Did you have a good summer?"
he asked with a huge grin. I was sure he did. With his golden tan, I imagine him lying by a pool from May to August, or running along the beach next to the multi-million-dollar beach home his parents likely owned. "No."
"Did you even try?"
"No." I was beginning to get annoyed with the stream of students ahead of me who were taking far too much time to choose their seat. "Hi, Benji." Stephanie Becker lilted from her seat. She was short, but had stunning curves, and she twirled a piece of her long blonde hair while staring at him with the most ridiculous look on her face. Her head was tilted, and her eyes clouded over when Benji looked for the source of his spoken name.
"Hi,"
he said, giving her only a moment of his time before turning back to me.
"I was hoping you'd be in this class."
His brown eyes brightened. Even if he did have a strong jawline and a sweet disposition, I still couldn't see him as anything but, well, Benji.
We've just heard Apollonia by Jamie McGuire. Science fiction places us in situations we have not yet encountered. It tests our inner nature against new and extreme conditions. How will human values and emotions change or endure in a far-flung future? How much can we change and still be human? Aliens and droids aside, science fiction is also often a genre full of ideas, optimism, and inspiration. I hope you agree, today's show was a worthwhile exploration. For more titles across the genre and the galaxies, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for journeying with us today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.